you tell us a bit more about Israel and its use, or if it's at all involved with biological chemical weapons?
No, Israel is, you know, it has a whole range of weapons. Nuclear, biological, chemical. The biological and chemical warfare manufacturing and development is in a place called Nes Ziona, which is a town not far from Tel Aviv. Israel has chemical weapons, biological weapons, and the biological weapons, of course, get into nanotechnology as well. But for example, just to give you one little tiny example, and that is that nanoweaponry is really, in many ways, biological weaponry. Nanotechnology has a very benevolent, if you go out, the people like nanotechnology because it's associated with biomedicine. So if you have circulatory problems, you can put up a nano gauge in your blood vein that measures your blood flow, and it's a good thing. But all these are byproducts of the military, because the military is the source of these technologies, really. And part of the nanotechnology capability, for example, with this smart dust, you can program this dust to incapacitate an entire population. You can attack a population's Gaza. You can attack a population's nervous system by nanobots that infiltrate into the body and contaminate the blood system or certain organs. You can use, and they're developing, you can use nanotechnology to affect the mind. You can take an entire population and make it forget. You can hit particular parts of the brain. You can take an entire population and make them laugh uncontrollably. In other words, nanotech, and it's really invisible stuff. So I think these sorts of things are getting into forms of biological and chemical warfare that are much more dangerous and pervasive than the older forms. And Israel is really one of the leaders.
Jeff, I was almost convinced there through that talk that you must be on the sales team of the, of the Israeli industry. But
somebody said that to me the other day. sounds great. You know, where do I sign?
But your very important question of how does Israel get away with it? It really is the elephant in the room. The answer, isn't it? I mean, can we put anything on Malcolm X's? And I've got the quote here so that I don't misquote him. The media is the most powerful entity on earth. They have the power to make the innocent guilty and make the guilty innocent. They control the minds of the masses. Malcolm X.
But without getting into that, part of that has to do with what I was calling reframing. Because the media needs to be also trained in the use of words. What are buzzwords? What are words that mislead you? Because not all the journalists are so clever. And that's really one of the specialties of Israel, is to feed journalists with a kind of a language that blames the victims and leaves the powerful off the hook. Brian, yes.
Thank you. I was having a friendly argument with a comrade the other day, and he was maintaining that Israel, like the USSR, would collapse. And nobody predicted, even the criminologists never predicted the USSR would collapse. And I quoted various things from your book. I said, look, they've got it all sewn up. Mm-hmm. They've got the East on China, India, all the rest. Even if America fails, they've got it all sewn up. So is there any sign that the whole thing could collapse?
Well, I mean, ironically, maybe I'm contradicting myself, but I think yes. I think there is an Achilles heel. And that, again, is the Palestinians. And one of the reasons I'm writing this is to look, I couldn't present, and it's true, I have to really think of how I'm presenting this. I don't want to leave the impression that it's all sewn up and that we're all losing and they're all powerful. These are totalizing weapons and we might as well just submit. That's the whole idea of what I'm trying to say is in order for us to resist and to get to a real counter-hegemony and a new system, we want to know what we're facing. And we have, you know, in order to develop really effective tactics. So in a sense, I'm trying to empower us to resist rather than... And I think the Palestinians show that as well. I mean, with all this technology we're talking about, everything, Israel has not pacified the Palestinians. I mean, even today, if you look at what's happening in the last week or two, the resistance is going on. I think Palestinians have been effective in, to some degree, in changing public opinion. You have BDS movements. In other words, there's still that element of resistance that's I think it has to be more effective and it has to be more strategic in a way. So from my point of view, Israel, the whole thing could collapse. Not so much Israel, but the whole situation, in my view, if the Palestinian Authority leaves the scene. As long as the PA is there with Abu Mazen and these guys, Nothing's going to happen. I mean, the Palestinians are living under two occupations. And I think what could happen, and it's between analysis and wishful thinking, with what's going on today, it's not that necessarily it's a third intifada, what's happening on the ground, but that the resistance and the violence that's generated, especially by young Palestinians, will create such an overreaction on the part of Israel. Because Israel has to prove to the world that it's pacifying the Palestinians. I mean, it undercuts their whole marketing. If the Palestinians are able to resist with rocks, the whole IDF that's trying to tell the world that we know the way that you can pacify everybody. So a lot is riding on the pacification of the Palestinians. And I think what could happen, one scenario is that Israel would so overreact that it would finally push Abu Mazen over the edge. And the guy would resign, or the PA would collapse. I mean, the PA is seen as a collaborationist regime by its own people. And if the PA is out of the way, then I think you've got a really almost an untenable situation on the part of Israel. You've got millions of Palestinians, impoverished, no infrastructure. I don't think the United States and Europe would pick up that slack. You'd have chaos, you'd have violence. I think it would inflame the Arab and Muslim and worlds, but beyond that as well. And I think that the collapse of the PA, that could happen soon, inshallah, would be a game changer. So that, again, you know, it's like, you look at the United States and all these, you know, look at the Soviet Union. I mean, they were all powerful, powerful countries with these militaries, but with feet of clay. And in the end, you know, these big powers tend to collapse. And I think that's going to happen in the Israeli case. I think it's an untenable situation. But in the meantime, of course, Israel has a tremendous impact outside.
I'm glad you said that because you talked about resistance, because I very much think that what you're doing here is extremely important. But I totally agree with your last point that we shouldn't be paralyzed by the apparent omnipotence of the new technologies.
That's right.
And I'd be interested to know kind of your comments on the difference between the situation in the region now in 2015, and what we saw in 2011, we had mass popular uprisings across the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Particularly, you mentioned Egypt. Now, as you said, Egypt is one of the strongest backers of Israel in the region. Mm-hmm. The Egyptian regime went through an enormous crisis because of ordinary people going into the streets, using non-violent, largely, methods of protest, although there was some, I think, rightly targeted violence at the machinery of repression itself. Now, that revolution was defeated, but I think the Palestinian resistance can play a really important role in, potentially, in the longer term, the revival of that kind of movement. And I just wanted to briefly say to people quickly that Abdel Fattah Sisi, the Egyptian president, is supposed to be coming to London. He's been invited officially by David Cameron. So if people want to know some information about the campaign against his visit, then please come and pick up leaflets afterwards. And I would invite anyone here who's involved with Palestine Society, with BDS, to come and part protest against that. Because this, in terms of house demolitions, Sisi has been flattening Rafah from the Egyptian part. So, you know, the struggle has to be recovered.
A lot of it has to do with security politics, again, because two countries very close to each other, besides Egypt and Israel, are Israel and Saudi Arabia. And here, in terms of normal politics, I mean, that's crazy. I mean, Saudi Arabia is the mother and father of Al-Qaeda and certain types of Islamic fundamentalism, and it's certainly not pro-Zionist, and it can't. But remember back in 2002, you had what was called the Arab Peace Initiative, which is also called the Saudi Peace Initiative. Saudi Arabia is the one that pushed through the Arab League unanimously this offer to Israel that we'll all make peace with you if you give up the occupation, basically. And Israel, of course, said no, but I think there was a subtext to that. And I think the subtext was Saudi Arabia was saying to Israel, we want you to be the regional hegemon. Because if you take away the Palestinians, and the Palestinians aren't seen sympathetically by a lot of the Arab world, and certainly the governments of the Arab world either. I mean, they're seen as a threat. But if you take away all that conflict, Israel has almost identical interests with the conservative Arab regimes. I mean, Israel sent crowd control materials to the Egyptian regime when it was putting down the Arab Spring, for example. You know, it needs Israel against Iran, against the Shiite forces and so on, but it also needs Israel in a securocratic way against its own peoples. So that's a really good example of how security is translated into hegemony. Because ironically, it's the Arab world, or the conservative Arab world, let's say, that wants Israel to be the hegemon, rather than having the Arab-Israeli conflict. So another, I think the difference is the Arab-Israeli conflict took place at a time when Israel didn't have that much clout, and there was more of an ideological kind of a tension. But the minute Israel began to acquire this military securocratic clout, that changed the whole. Now we want them to be our friends, and so on. So it's a good example of how everything turns on its head.
I'd just like to ask, when the IDF have ended spokespeople, they come out and say that they're frightened of forces like Hezbollah. Do they really mean it? Is it part of their framing method? Or are they genuinely terrified of what people, of what groups like Hezbollah are capable of? Because after 2006, or during 2006 even, during that war, I think the IDF they caught quite off guard.
Right.
And they're very surprised at what they encountered. Some of the tanks that he showed, the Hezbollah managed to destroy a few of them. And
right.
And since then, they had sort of upped their rhetoric about how dangerous and capable Hezbollah are as a force.
I think a lot of that is hype, because I think you know, Israel's trying to build up its adversaries, and so when it knocks them down, it makes much more of an impression. For example, one of the outcomes of the 2006 war in Lebanon, what was called the Dahiya Doctrine, that I write about in the book, where the Israeli Air Force in particular, attacked the neighborhood of Dahiya in Beirut, which is the kind of the stronghold or the center of the Hezbollah in Beirut, in the laws of war, in the Fourth Geneva Convention, and in different laws of war, you're not allowed to use disproportional force, certainly against the civilian population. And Israel basically said, Hezbollah is such a danger, but it's a danger not in terms of Hezbollah itself, but in terms of representing the kinds of non-state actors that the global north and all these elites are faced with.